भद्रं कर्णे पश्यन्याम देवाः भद्रं पश्ये माक्षभिर्यचत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तु नूभिः व्यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः.
I have up to 45.
I turned this off so it would take a long time for me to get it for you.
I'll survive.
Yeah. We're on 46. Good, yeah. Chapter 3, last three verses. Okay. Yadana liyate chittam. Yadana liyate chittam. Nacha vikshipyate punaha. Nacha vikshipyate punaha. Anigamanam anabhasam. Aniganam anabhasam nishpannam brahmatattada nishpannam brahmatattada yada na liyate chittam na cha vikshipyate punaha aniganam anabhasam nishpannam brahmatattada. That's aniganam. Kind of an unusual aninganam. Yeah. So, as a sadhana, as an aid to recognizing this, to owning up this knowledge, Gaudapada has given kind of four upayas, or four what we call like pratibandhakas or obstructions. That can happen at the time of meditation. So he's really talking about nididhyasana. So if the shravana manana is not enough and the mind needs to have some time just to actually be with the self, to withdraw the mind in such a way that it can just recognize its own being, this nididhyasana is necessary and useful. And it is really part of the sadhana for gaining this knowledge, shravana manana nididhyasana. So nididhyasana is an important part. You know, it gives the mind a chance to break the dehatma buddhi. Dehatma buddhi means the mind's beginningless tendency to take itself to be one with the upadis, the body, mind, sense organs, and their characteristics. Right? So the characteristics, say I take myself to be the mind, but I could also take myself then to be whatever qualities are going on in the mind. I could be happy, sad, agitated. The body, I could be a man or a woman, I can be fat, tall, old, etc. Whatever the qualities are, I take myself to be those. And it's not the Atma, it's not taking itself to be that. The Atma doesn't have any ajnana. The Atma, my being, is just pure conscious being. It has no problem whatsoever. The one who has the problem is the body-mind-sense organs, which would be the mind, really. The mind is the one that is suffering from self-ignorance, and that self-ignorance has caused it to take itself to be, right, what that which is always there. Why shouldn't it? Why shouldn't the mind take itself to be the consciousness which it continually enjoys, no matter which vritti is there? So it's absolutely normal and natural for the mind to make that mistake, because it's almost like the air that you breathe. It's never not there. And so a teaching has to come along that, like a mirror, helps the mind to differentiate its mithya self, its mithya nature, right, from the changeless being that it enjoys. It's a differentiation from the mithya mind that is continually changing, from its own self, which is never changing. That differentiation has to be made. And so sometimes the mind is too active, too involved. It has too many raga dveshas, too many likes and dislikes, too many unconscious issues, too many things going on for it to have the shanti necessary to simply at the time of teaching resolve into what the words are pointing at. Because even if it does resolve, as the words are pointing to yourself who is here, it's not like you're not here, you're here. So the mind is available, can be very available, especially if you're somebody like Swamiji who's just cracking the perfect joke at the perfect time to kind of clear your mind of any type of stress. You know, it just makes you into an adhikari, and then this knowledge just flows in, you see, you understand. But when you walk out the door, all these likes and dislikes, all these raga dveshas come up, all these kind of beginningless habits, habitual ignorance, habitual self-ignorance that we have lifetimes and lifetimes of. And so in order to break that dehatma buddhi, deha means body. Body can be subtle body, physical body. That the Atma is the body. That Atma is my mind. That buddhi, that conviction that I am this body, mind, sense organs. That's a conviction that I've been living with, that conviction from beginningless time. And so when you expose yourself to knowledge, chances are that that conviction is going to continually reassert itself. Right? Especially when there's raga dvesha. When there's likes and dislikes, the jiva immediately rises its head. Because I want this. When I want this, I become someone in this world who wants this. There's many times in samsara when you're not a samsari experientially. There's those moments when everything is fine, when you don't want anything to be different. At that time, the jivatva, it's there, because the ajnana is still there, but it's very sublated. It's not active, you know. So you're like a jnani for the moment, right? Because you're right in the present, you're not asking anything to be different. You're that ananda, that shanti is there. Okay, so realizing that the shravana and manana probably is not enough because of this habitual ignorance, you know, the habitual behavior, lifetimes of it. This nididhyasana is something that is necessary and is taught as one of the sadhanas, shravana, manana, nididhyasana, in order to break down this dehatma buddhi, the conviction that the deha is the atma. Means that the ahankara, so just to understand this a little more technically, the ahankara, the I notion, is something which is born of self-ignorance. The I notion, when we say ahankara, what we mean, we've created an I on this body, we've given the I to this body, we've created this is me. This is a creation born of ignorance. That the I is this mind, that's ahankara. That's born of ignorance. That the Atma, the self that I am, has now become this mind. That's ahankara. That's ajnana born. Okay, so this ahankara has got to become as mithya as the body, mind, sense organs that are part of this duality. Right? It has to become sublated. So even though I say, in language I say, I'm going to the store, Atma is not going to the store. Myself is not doing anything. Myself is the very adhishtana of the whole creation. So I'm not doing anything. I'm not changing. If I say, oh, I'm so tired, my body is tired. Atma doesn't become tired, you know. Or if I say, you know, my eyes are getting dim, I have to get some new glasses. Atma doesn't have dimming eyes, right? But I talk in this language, recognizing that the aham that I'm using is as mitya, as the body, mind, sense organs, that is taking on this word, right? Otherwise, my language would have to change. As I gain knowledge, I'd have to change my language. You know, the eyes are becoming dim, the body's walking to the store, the mind is feeling agitated. I am Brahman, however, right? We're not going to do that. So the ahankara becomes sublated, it becomes mitya, along with the body, mind, and rest of the creation. And the aham rises in my mind when I'm talking about me. It resolves into me, into the Atma, into the self. That means that Ajnanam is no longer there. I've differentiated my presence, my being, my changeless being, my ever-present being, from all of the things that are going on. Things means what's ever going on in my mind, but all the emotions that are going on, whatever's going on in the body, what's ever going on in the world. All of these things, right, are taking place in me, who's not doing anything at all. I simply am. I bless the whole thing. My being is the blessing. It's the blessing. It is the one who is present to all of this activity, myself not doing anything at all. And so, with knowledge, that viveka, that discrimination takes place, so that now, when this dehatma buddhi has been more or less broken, I've given it some time, now when the aham arises, it resolves into me. I am the aham, the atma. The self that I actually am is the self I take myself to be. Before knowledge, that self that I actually am is as much there, but it's just superimposed upon all of these things that are actually objectified, like my body, my mind, sense organs. It's not that I is any less present. It's absolutely present as me, but the mind confuses me with itself. And then, like a bouncing ball, it confuses itself with the body. So the mind takes itself to be the conscious being, and then it takes itself to belong to the body. So there's this bouncing ball. Right? And then any type of wholeness or fullness, it's totally dependent on particular types of shantavrittis in order for it to feel whole and complete. So that viveka is not there, but just because the viveka is not there, the discrimination is not there, doesn't mean I'm not there. I'm completely there. You know, it would be like saying, if you use the analogy of the clay pot, that until the pot has knowledge of its clayness, the clay is covered. The clay is not covered. What is the difference between the pot that has recognized that it's clay, that it's dependent on the clay, and the clay is free from it, then the experience of the pot that takes the clayness to belong to it, and therefore when the pot breaks, the clay will be gone. See what I mean? Nothing is covered. Nothing's covered. Whether you're the Ajnani pot, the Ajnani clay pot, or the Jnani clay pot. Experience is exactly the same, but what the mind does with it is different. One is subject to ignorance and aviveka, lack of discrimination between itself, the mitya pot, and the satyam clay. And the other is very clear. It realizes that there's really nothing there but clay. And if the pot becomes a plate, nothing happens to the clay. So if this body dies and takes on another body, nothing happens to me. If I have this thought and there's this thought, nothing happens to me. If I go from the waking state to the dream state to the deep sleep state back to the waking state, nothing happens to me. In fact, nothing ever happens to me. And that stable being, my stable being, is what we call aparoksha. It's self-evident. It's always there exactly the same way. And once you realize it, you also realize, not that, oh, now I'm stable, you realize it has always been this way, I just didn't realize it. It's all clear. You realize nothing has happened, I just didn't know. It's not that all of a sudden Atma has become stable because now I'm enlightened. It's not that there's an enlightened self and an unenlightened self. It's just one non-dual self that the mind either knows or it doesn't know, recognizes or doesn't recognize. But the relationship of the mind to that self is like the relationship of the pot to the clay. Right? There is no mind without the self. The self is the very me of the mind. If I say, what do you mean I'm not my mind? I am my mind. Here I am. I am my mind. I would say, you're absolutely correct. You are your mind. Right? But you're also free of your mind. The mind enjoys you 100%. Without you, the mind would not exist. But your being never changes at all. And that is the knowledge that has to take place. So now, what he did, what Gaudapada did, was spend now these verses for the end, getting us to the end of chapter 3, to help you understand this meditative process and what it means really to withdraw, to pull the mind back into its own being, instead of having the mind wandering around in mitya, wandering around focusing on this object or this object or this object, you know, or this emotion or this emotion or this emotion or this experience or this experience. So the mind is always kind of moving around in the world of these changing experiences, in this world of duality, in this world of samsara, with my being there, blessing the whole thing changelessly. But the mind is all doing all of this stuff, okay? So now we're saying, okay, we have to pull this mind back home. We want to bring it home. So it's not running around, you know, engaged in all of these different experiences. So he says there's different things that can happen when you try to bring the mind home to its own being. You know? But one of the things that can happen is because of raga dvesha, your likes and dislikes, it's very busy, it's agitated, it wants this, it wants that, and what about this, and what about that? You know? Because these are concerns, because raga dvesha means my mind is lacking a little vairagya, and so it still thinks, I want this so that I can be happy, and I don't want this so that I, you know, so that I can be happy. So the anandas is, it is projected out here, and the mind is still busy working away at all of that, you know. And so vikshepa means we have to say, okay, let's come home to where the true source of ananda is. Because you have knowledge, you're mumukshi, you're getting knowledge. So now the mind is habitually behaving this way, so let me bring it home. That's the vikshepa. I have to bring it back. Right? Because of my knowledge, I bring it back. Another thing that can happen is laya. You sit down to meditate and you think, oh, I want to fall asleep. So when you do that, when that happens, you have to stand up and put some water on your face and walk around. So Amji says, if you start to fall asleep, stop right there. Get up, walk around, go outside. Because otherwise you'll develop the samskara that when I sit to meditate, I fall asleep. So no, get up. So these two things, don't let these happen. Next interesting one is, which shows the psychology, is this kashaya. You're not falling asleep. Your mind's not big shape. It's not running around. But it's dull. There's no absorption happening. And so when that's happening, you should know that there's unconscious processes going on that wants some attention. And that's when, if there's not any absorption and your mind's quiet but there's no absorption, that's a good time to say, does anybody have any side, have anything they want to say? What's going on? What's bothering? Is somebody something bothering you? Then you do that unconscious work to let those little ones that are feeling agitated or those parts of the psyche that they're in the unconscious, give them some attention, and then they'll become available for contemplation. Otherwise, they're like a wall because they want your attention. So that's the kshaya. The fourth one, so say we have these three taken care of, then what happens is the mind gains some shanti and ananda comes in the mind. That's the next problem. Ananda comes in the mind. And then you say, wow, that's great. And the mind starts revolving around that experience of ananda, you know, and becomes extrovert again. So he says, when that ananda comes, when everything's quiet, just leave it. Just leave it alone. Let that absorption to continue to happen. Hands off. Okay? Just let it happen. So now, having gone through these things and kind of given you these instructions, then yada na liyate chittam. When the mind is no longer falling asleep, okay, that's over. Nacha vikshipyate punaha. And when it's no longer running around, raga dvesha, agitated, wanting this and wanting that. Aninganam. When it has actually become quiet, aninganam, becomes silent. Gamanam, you know, it comes from this gum, to go. Mm-hmm. Aningamam means it's motionless. Right? No vikshepa, no sleep, it's become quiet. Then anabhasam. It's no longer producing objective objects. It's no longer producing thoughts. You know, like this thought will rise, or this nama rupa, this name will form, will rise. It's not producing any thoughts, anabhasam, so that activity in the mind is not happening. So when the mind becomes like that, then nishpannam brahman, brahma tat, then that chitta, or that chitta, brahman is gained. Brahman is gained. What they mean by that is the chitta means the mind. So you have to understand this nishpannam, what does it mean to gain brahman? You have to understand the whole satya mitya. For the pot to gain the clay, there is the pot already is clay. Right? For your mind to gain Brahman, the mind already is Brahman. Right? It already is that. But all that's happened is that the mitya, the activity of the mind, which is mitya, means has no being of its own, needs to be withdrawn, right? Michael, are you okay?
Yeah, I'm sorry, am I bothering
you? Yeah.
Sorry.
You're okay. You've got that, right?
I found it.
Oh, sorry. You found it. Okay. Okay.
I was looking for it. You were right.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. It's just coming in and starting to get in my mind.
Okay.
So, to really understand what he's saying, the whole Vedanta, you have to understand this relationship between satyam and mitya. Without that, there's no advaita. And also, the mind has some real substance to it other than Brahman. But if you understand the satyam mitya, the very me, the very conscious being that I am, that is Brahman. That is the self of the mind. It is the clay of the pot. Right? And so the problem with the mind is that it's involved with itself. One vritti is involved with the next vritti, with the next vritti, with the next vritti, never recognizing the self, you know, which is the very substance, changeless substance, of all of those thoughts. Like, for instance, if I have one thought, is focused on another thought, is focused on another thought, all of that activity is taking place in one non-dual conscious me. So just think about it. You have this thought, this is my thought, so here's me, okay? You have this thought, this is my thought, I have this thought, this is my thought, I have this thought, this is my thought, I have a web of thoughts. All of them have for their being one non-dual me. That me is never changing, no matter how active the mind is. No matter how many emotions are flickering around in the mind. It's this me as this emotion, which generates this emotion, which generates this emotion, which generates this emotion, and commentaries on all of them. That's the activity of the mind, right? But there's only one changeless me, that non-dual me, that is the very self of all of this mental activity. And so all Gaudapada is asking you to do is to pull this mitya, this mental activity, that has no being of its own. To really understand that, let me just give a simple example. Here's me, my own being, and a thought appears. Okay? And then is displaced by another thought. And then displaced by another thought. Now, these thoughts, or emotions, or perceptions, they only enjoy being when they're there. When they're gone, they're gone. Nobody can retrieve them. Nobody. Right? Like say I have this thought. I have a thought, and now it's passed on because it's been replaced by another thought. So is that thought out in the ether somewhere that somebody can come and grab it? No, it's not anywhere. You know? It's like saying this is really understand mitya. There's nothing there. Now, this is another way to understand it. Here is this moment right now that's taking place in consciousness. It's your moment, right? Here it is, this moment. Well, way before I even open my mouth, that moment's gone. It's completely gone, not partially gone. It is completely gone. There's another problem. The next moment is completely not here, right? So this moment is completely gone. The next moment is not here, right? Now, what is so interesting about that, I mean, it's really not here. What is here is only the present, right? The present is here. The past, you would have to bring to the present through memory. The future, you have to project. But the only thing that is here is the present. And now you try to find the present here in duality. I never don't experience the present. I can only experience the present. Because the past isn't here, the future isn't here. That's just, you should be able to understand that. Because it's not trick language. I'm just being very straightforward. past is gone. Future has not come. So I can only experience in the present. I am only in the present, right? But if I were to try to find the present within duality, every moment is divisible into smaller moments. You know what they use? It's just so sweet. But the example they use for this is in the Shastra is an example that's been passed down. And Swamiji's used it. Say if you take, you know, in a puja, they get these piles and piles of rose petals that they offer to the deity. Say if I took a handful of those petals and I lined them up side by side by side by side by side till I had 500 petals, made to take that much space. And I take a little needle and I go, psh, okay. So now the amount of time, because petals are so delicate, that it took that needle to pass is a split second. If that, psh, that's over. Right? But it went through one petal at a time. And then if I were to put that petal through a microscope, it also went through, you know, one little bit of the petal, a little bit of the petal, a little bit of the... As long as the moment takes up space, it can be divided. As long as the moment takes up space, it takes up linear time, it can be divided. That means it's infinitely divisible, you know. And so you are always in the present, but actually... You never experience the present in duality. The present that you experience is the non-dual presence of your being. And that is what is constant. Your being is the presence in which this seemingly flow of time takes place. But always taking place in the presence of the hypothetical present. Right? Because you can never find the present out here. But you are that presence. So now look at your experience that we have within duality. all of the experiences coming and going and changing within the presence of my being. I am the stability. And the stability is the me of the present. And so now what has to happen, you know, is that Gaudapada's suggestion here is when the laya is gone, the vikshepa is gone, the kashayas are gone, the searching after sukha, when all of that has been controlled, all you're doing is, instead of letting the mind run around and do its maya thing, you know, throwing up one image after another, one perception after another, you're just bringing it to be quiet, right? Totally quiet. If it starts to go out, as the previous verse said, you just bring it home. You know? And what are you bringing it home to? The only thing that is actually there, right? The only thing that is actually here is me. The pot is not actually there. It's there, but it's not actually there. What is actually there is clay. Here, what is actually here is me. But the mind gets confused in its own activity, even though once you know this, once you've seen it, no matter how active the mind is, it's still only me. The activity doesn't make any difference at all. But I have to have recognized, the mind has had to have a chance to recognize the fact. Once it recognizes that this pretty, that pretty, this pretty, it's engaged in this, engaged in that, makes no difference. I'm the constant. So the mithya becomes mithya. It doesn't have any power over me. And so now, when this is so, my mind says, I am Brahman. The mind says, I am Brahman. Brahman is the truth. Brahman is what is actually here. It recognizes it because it's pulled the mind back, made it quiet, and then exactly what the Shastra says, I am the one who is left, and now I recognize that the one who is left never goes and can never go and can never be covered and never has been covered. At any time, the covering has been the covering of a jnanam, not the covering of a paper bag. You know, there's no covering other than the mind's taking what is absolutely present and self-evident to be, belong to itself. That's the covering. There's no real covering. And so when this phenomena is made clear, then the mind doesn't have to be resolved. The mind doesn't have to become quiet in order for it to recognize its being. It recognizes its being all the time. But it had to become quiet. It had to become quiet to resolve itself into the adhishtana, into the truth of itself, in order to, then when it becomes active again, realize that nothing's happening to me. But until then, it hasn't done that viveka. It has to do the viveka. Your mind, if your mind has a relative degree of shanti, that's enough. You know, because it has enough space to recognize this. It doesn't have to have some big non-dual experience. The non-dual is already present. But it has to have the capacity to do that viveka and recognize amidst all of this, all of these thoughts, all of these perceptions, I'm not touched in any way and I'm not changing at all. And cannot. That's what has to be seen. And so he's using this, you know, this meditative practice to help the student gain this nischa jnana, this clarity, this real clarity of knowledge that's irrefutable. Because until you have that aparoksha jnana, that direct, immediate recognition, then it's just, you haven't got it yet. That's all. You have to, we're talking about you. There's nobody that's more here than you, right? And so you're not going to have indirect knowledge of yourself. You know, you could have indirect knowledge of China, or, you know, but you're not going to have indirect knowledge of you because you are here. So it has to be directly recognized. So, now, he goes on. Swastam Shantam Sanirvanam. Swastam Shantam Sanirvanam. Akatyam Sukham Uttamam. Akatyam Sukham Uttamam. Ajam Ajena Gnyayena. Ajam Ajena Gnyayena. Sarvagnyam Parichakshate. Sarvagnyam Parichakshate. Swastam Shantam Sanirvanam. Akatyam Sukham Uttamam. Ajam Ajena Gnyayena. Sarvagnyam Parichakshate. He's talking now about this Atma, this self that you've recognized. It is swastyam, swastam. Swastam means it's abiding in itself. If we're talking about mithya, mithya is totally dependent upon the adhishtana. It's totally dependent on something else. Pot depends on clay, the rope, the snake depends upon the rope. Right, there's no independence. Whereas the Atma, Brahman, depends only on itself. It's not abiding in anything in order for it to be. Mithya has no being apart from its adhishtana. But the Atma has, the self has no adhishtana. It's not dependent on anything. It is the conscious being upon which everything depends. Right, so there's nothing else that is producing it or giving it its reality. It is self-evident, conscious being itself. And that is shantam. That nature of your being is shantam. It means there's no ripples in it because there's no duality. In mithya, within duality, which is mithya, within time and space, everything is infinitely divisible. Everything is affecting everything else. So there's constant change. The Atma is free of change. So with something that's absolutely free of change, as shanti. When your mind has shanti, you're not talking about an agitated mind, right? You're talking about a relative shanti, where the mind has become relatively quiet, because the mind by nature changes. Right? So if you're talking about, look at how peaceful the ocean is, there's no waves. That's a beautiful state, temporary, right? Because it has the capacity to become tumultuous. So your mind has the capacity, it enjoys shanti now, it has the capacity to become tumultuous or to become active, because that's the nature of the mind that exists within duality. Atma is shanta, means it does not have that capacity, it's non-dual, it is what it is and that's it. It doesn't have a prior condition, it doesn't have a posterior condition, it's free of time. And so the being, your being is absolutely shanta. It is sanirvanam. They said it is this Atma that we associate with nirvana or moksha, because the mind is the one that has to gain moksha, right? Your mind gains moksha. Atma is not gaining moksha. Atma is already liberated. Atma is already whole. It's non-dual. It's complete. There's nothing more to be gained, right? And so we're not going to say the Atma gains moksha. You know, mm-hmm. Or gains nirvana. But it's the Atma that the one who has, that the mind gains. The mind gains gains the Atma through the elimination of self-ignorance. Mm. And so it is this self that we associate with moksha. Right? Because it is the self that you are that is the liberated self. It's the mind, the mind's the one that has to recognize it. So sa means saha. Sanirvanam is the one who's associated with moksha itself. It has no bondage, so how can it have moksha? Oh, the Atma, you don't say the Atma has become liberated, right? The mind has become liberated, but the mind has become liberated by recognizing its adhishtana, which is the Atma. It is akatyam. Akatyam means it's not something that can be told. There's no words. When we talk about the words in terms of the primary meaning of the words, there are no words for the Atma. Right? What words within duality can we use? And so, in fact, the whole teaching methodology has to use these words that are used to name concepts that exist within duality, all of our languages for that, has to use words in the implied meaning of the words to point to something that is there to be seen. But you can't, like I can, if I say to you the word pot, then in your mind, pot will come. If I say book, a book will come. If I say lamp, a lamp will come. Tree, a tree will come. It's instantaneous. There's always a direct relationship from the word to its object, right? And if you don't, if I can say gugubuga, that's Swamiji's, nothing comes. It's your mind goes, you know. But if there was such a thing of gugubuga, right, I could teach you that and show it to you, and then the word would mean something, and when I said the word, that would come. But what word do we have available to us that saying it will evoke that? It can't. It can't unless the words have been used in such a way as to point the mind to something that is there to be recognized. Why this can happen is because your self is there, right? And the self can be differentiated from all of the different thoughts and moods and emotions and the whole of duality, in fact. It can be differentiated. And so the teaching, that's what we say, the Upanishad is a teaching, it's a pramana. It's a means of knowledge, right, that takes you step by step, takes the mind step by step by step to recognizing this. Right? It's not going to be, you know, using words that themselves hold the answer. That's why these words have to be used in a particular way according to a teaching tradition that takes the mind of the student step by step by step by step. That's what we call it. The Upanishads are called a pramana. They're a teaching that's been gone from beginningless time between guru and sisha, passed down from guru to sisha, teacher to student, teacher to student, teacher to student. Kind of like they use the example like lighting, say you have one candle flame, it lights the other candle flame. Now you have two candle flames. That's another candle flame. Now you have three candle flames. These flames are all the same. Because the self is there, the self is there to be recognized. Your being is there to be recognized. And so these words are handled in such a way to direct the mind to this recognition, because it's there to be seen. But it's not something that can be talked about as you talk about the rest of the world, whatever exists and can be objectified in duality. You say the word and it brings the object. Now, it is true that once you know, because of been exposed to it, so you've recognized yourself, then you say the word and it brings the self. Then you can do nididhyasana. Then you can say shantoham, I am shanti. And your mind just resolves into the fact. I am consciousness resolves into the fact. I am Brahman resolves into the fact. I am Ishwara resolves into the fact. But that's because now you know. Otherwise, it doesn't go anywhere. You know, mm-hmm. You might intuitively say, "I think that's true," but I need to know. Intuitively, we know without knowing. Then also, sukham uttamam. It is the highest sukha, not the greatest bliss. Yeah. Uttamam means that sukha, that ananda, that has no equal. That is true in two ways. The very swarupa of yourself, right, is the beloved. There is nothing more dear. Even at this moment, in the middle of a dukkha vritti, in the middle of agitation, that which is most dear is still aparoksha, is still self-evident. But also, from the standpoint of the mind gets a tremendous amount of joy in its knowledge of the limitless, changeless nature of me. There's an incomparable joy, and I'm not talking about a bliss. I'm talking about wholeness, satisfaction, the resolution of what you've been seeking for all of your life, you know? That total fulfillment is there. There's no sukha greater than that. So the mind enjoys the sukha of having resolved The problem that it's had for lifetimes, lifetimes, lifetimes has now resolved in the recognition of my own being.
Mm.
And my own being itself is limitless ananda. Not bliss. It's the ananda, the beloved nature of my being that doesn't have a counterpoint here. There's no... The word ananda, when it's pointing to me, doesn't match any ananda that I've ever experienced here. Because what I've experienced here are ananda vrittis, right? Ananda vrittis that come and go. Bliss or happiness or joyful vrittis that have a beginning and an end. The ananda that is myself doesn't have a beginning and end. It's ajam. It's unborn. It means it's not created and it doesn't go away. So that's why when you recognize yourself, you are recognizing something that has always been there and you know that it has always been there. Right? That's part of the beauty of it. It's not like you think, oh, I didn't know that was there. You know? You recognize what you know has always been there. That's part of the amazing thing about it. So it's ajam. That's the next word, ajam. And then this, parichakshate, they call, means those wise people, the munis, those who have this knowledge, they call that ajam sarvajnam, means limitless knowledge, limitless consciousness, sarvajnam. Why? Because of being associated with jnayena, that which is to be known, which is itself unborn. So the jnani, for instance, recognizes that it's this very self that is this sanirvanam, is the one who's associated with nirvana, with moksha, is the one who is unborn, is the one who is pure conscious being and must be Brahman. There's more to say about this, but must by its nature be Brahman, because there's not going to be two things that are unborn. And there can't be two things that are just non-dual limitless consciousness. You can't have, oh, here we have non-dual, limitless, changeless, unborn consciousness over here, and here we have another non-dual, limitless, unborn consciousness here, neither which is objectifiable. So there's no way for there to be two. So then you recognize, along with this teaching, this is encapsulating the whole thing, but that this conscious being itself that I am is Brahman. Right? Because there's no way to make it two. There's no way to objectify it. No way to make the infinite, what is by its very swarupa, very nature, limitless, changeless, unborn. There's no way for there to be two of us. There can only be one of us. And all of the things that exist within Maya must, by their very nature, be mitya. Because anything that exists within duality fulfills by its nature the definition of mitya. The definition of mitya is that which has non-existence on either side. That which comes into being and goes out of being. Right there, mitya, bound by time. Mitya, that's all you need. If it's mitya, then it can't have any being of its own because it comes into being and goes out of being. Anything that comes into being and goes out of being, that had a prior condition of not being, has no being of its own. Because you've just said it. It had a prior condition of not being. If it had a prior condition of not being, it has no being. Something that has no being can't come into being. It's not possible. Or you're using the words incorrectly. Say if I say something had no existence before, now it's been born. Well, what was its prior condition? He said, it wasn't there. It had no prior condition. Okay, then it had no being. It came out of non-being. That's not possible. Nothing can come out of non-being, because when you say non-being, we mean it wasn't there. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's mitya. That means it depends on something else for its being. Mm-hmm. That's why clay pot is it's a drishtanta. All illustrations are limited. But it's a good one. So if you have a pot, say if you have a lump of clay and you make it into a pot. The pot has come into being. The pot was not there before. It's mitya. Mitya means that it depends on something else. What? clay. Clay was there before, right? But pot wasn't. So there's no such thing as a pot. There's only clay. But the pot is there. It's mithya. Whole creation, everything that you experience is mithya. It comes into being and goes out of being. It's infinitely divisible. There's nothing here. And yet, if you try to find something here, you can't find it. But no matter how many operations you're getting involved with in terms of, analyzing the reality of the world, no matter what you do to the creation or what you do to your experience, all of it, without any exception, takes place in being. Being itself is the adhishtana. Who's being? We can say my being, but there's no my. My being, as though I have been, I am the being. This me, this conscious being, is the being. And it is me. It is so personal. It's not somebody else. It's just I know you very intimately because my being, this being that is me, is the being of all beings. This very personal me, there's only one of us, right? And it happens to be me, I'm sorry. But this very personal me, right, is the personal me that all beings enjoy, that Ishwara enjoys. It is the adhishtana, And so you couldn't know anyone more intimately than that. And that goes also for all animals, for all living beings, for all beings, for the whole creation. We have to know this. Mm. You think that animals don't... Anyway. It's so important, though. It's so important that they are you, the same self that you have is their self, And Ishwara, the whole Ishwara, all of the devatas, all of the bad people, all of the rakshasas, all of the asuras, the upadis are a little different, the satra, rajas, tamas. We have a lot of these tamas upadis and rakshasa upadis and sattva upadis, all gradiated, all different types, but they all enjoy just one self, just me, one me, this me. Now think about it, you don't really understand, think of it when you have a dream. All of those characters that are in that you dream universe that's projected with all of those characters and all the animals and the birds and the butterflies, that is all Ishwara enjoying me, one me. I am Ishwara, the conscious being that I am, this me. This self is the self of the whole creation. Everything in this creation is me. And so, as we know that, as we really know that, then we start to act more like that. we're good at acting like that toward our body because... Even as an Ajnani, I know this is me. And I take care of it to the best as I can with all of my addictions and whatnot. Taking care of the mind and all of that the best that we can because it's me. We might do it with a lot of Ajnanam and make a lot of mistakes, but, I'm doing what I can for myself. Now we have to, as we start to know, we want to do what we can for myself, right? It's a bigger self. It's Ishwara, Mm-hmm. I won't give my vegetarian speech. Because it's 10 to 9. Get spared.
Maybe next time.
Next time. We all got that from Swamiji. Swamiji's always giving... his speech. He can't help himself.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with the speech.
No, but I used to think, oh no. Oh no, here we go. Because once he starts, he really goes for a long time on it. I love that anyway.
Next time.
Okay, let's take a break. say prayer. Om swasti prajapyah paripalintam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha go brahmanebhyah shivamastu nityam loka samasta sukino pavantu kale varshatu parajanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yam chobarahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhak bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritangamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Hari Om.
So if this me, this pure conscious being is me, it is kind of, I have a sense of that, that personal me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sense of personal me exactly the same in all the upadis? I mean, I can see it in human beings, but same as in cows and...
Yeah, that's a good, because that's what some people don't, can get confused here, because this the me... Sense of me, I don't mean that in a dual way. If we just want to, what is the self-evident nature, self-shining nature of you?
Yeah.
Okay. That belongs to the self. It doesn't belong to the mind or to the sense organs or the body. It doesn't belong to mitya.
Exactly.
It belongs to you. And so even if the whole creation is resolved, that personal me is what is shining, that's the very nature of reality. This me is the nature of reality. You know, this self-evident, self-shining me-ness. Right? And so this me that is me is the me of the mosquito. It's the me of the snake. It's the me of the of all beings.
So if I were a cat, say, I would be having the same experience.
Yes, because the cat is not having the experience. It's not an experience that the mind is having, or that Ishwara is having. The experience is the self-evident experience of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't belong to... Everything in the creation enjoys that me, not because the mind is reflecting it or aware of it, but because that is the nature of the self.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so it's not dependent on the existence or presence or absence of the mind or the body or the manifestation of the creation. You know, just imagine, if we use the imagination or dream example, if a dream comes, that whole dream enjoys that such shit. the me, the conscious being. Right? And all of the little dream characters enjoy it, and also the whole dream enjoys it. When the dream goes away, nothing happens to that. That's who you are. And you are not, I could say you are not mitya. The mitya totally is dependent upon you, but you're not dependent on it. Whether it's manifest or not manifest,
mm-hmm.
makes no difference to your own sense of self, or your own self-evident nature. You know what I mean by self-evident? If we say sense of self, somehow that works for me, but we have to say it in different ways to make sure that those words aren't confusing.
So if you're searching to see your identity shining in another,
you're not going to see it by looking at it. You're looking at it, you'll just see the nama rupa, the name and form.
Yeah.
But you know, because you have knowledge that the me that you are is the me that's illumining everything and every upadi.
Yeah.
Even now, like if you just can relax and you look at this room through your sense organs, yourself, the self-evident me-ness of you, it's not contained. You have to relax a little bit to notice that fact. But in fact, it's not contained. It's not big. It's not small. You're not a little pea in a pod. And you're also not big taking up space. Just think of it like if you have an imagination, say if I say, imagine a beautiful seascape or something like that. Just imagine a seascape. Now that whole vast, beautiful ocean, you can look at the shore and the clouds and whatnot, all of that time and space that's included in that imagination, all of that is now taking place in you. You haven't stretched out, you haven't taken on time and space, but time and space exists in the existence which itself is free of time and space. You're not big or small or tall. These words don't apply. You're not white or black or yellow. The words don't apply. Those apply to concepts within duality, not to me. And so now if you just kind of relax and just be just your own self-evident me-ness, your own presence, now, is it contained? Just notice it. Is it contained? Is it like located somewhere in your body or located somewhere out here? Or you're not contained at all. There's no place where you're not, but you're not stretched out either, and you're not a little, you don't have anything to do with time and space, but there's nothing away from you. You should work with your imagination a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can see, if you imagine something and notice, where are you in that imagination? Not your body, your being. You're not in it, and you're not out of it. You're a different order of reality.
So there are lots of people who their minds are as though covered up. Their experience of their sense of self, because
mm-hmm.
of their ignorance, is as though covered by that ignorance, right?
Well, it depends on what you mean by covered.
That's why I said as though, but
I know, but
their minds don't distinguish.
That's right. The self is completely present. It's not covered at all, but it isn't differentiated by the mind from its own thoughts. So the conscious being is taken to be happy or be sad or be smart or be stupid or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of following up on Edward's question. With animals, can that kind of thing happen? Or are they more like yonis from the get-go?
No.
Or can they be ignorant? Or are they always, where do they...
The thing about with animals is, it seems to me that the animal, it's not that the animals have self-knowledge or not self-knowledge, it's kind of a non-issue. But they don't have the complexes in the same way that humans do, and they seem to be able to be much more present and in the moment. It's not that they don't, I mean, I know, like for Tibby, I know that she thinks and she works through things and she can be happy and she can be, She has many different ranges of intelligence, you know. But I don't think that she is thinking about gaining self-knowledge. I don't think it's an issue for her. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that herself isn't myself. The self, needing to self-knowledge or not self-knowledge, this all belongs to the upadhi. It depends upon what are the needs of the mind. Many humans never think about self-knowledge either. It's only a few. Mm-hmm. It's only a minority of people that even have the question. But the problem is, you know, animals seem much more in tune with nature and with their own instincts, you know, than humans. Humans are very complex, you know, and they have a buddhi and they have kartritvam, this sense of doership and enjoyership, and they have a lot of complexity. Animals are more simple, more straightforward.
So with their upadhi, do they experience the self the same way I experience the self? I mean,
that's what I'm trying to make you understand this. The self experience belongs to the self. It does not belong to the mind. Your mind is not contributing to your self experience at all. I mean, not at all.
But I am experiencing something, though.
Yeah.
As a self.
The self is its own experience.
Yeah.
But it's not, the experience is not dependent upon having a mind or not having a mind. It doesn't belong to the mind. It doesn't belong to the body.
No, I'm looking at you.
You could just easily go into plants, because then plants have self.
See, now, we can do even more than that. See, I could say, and maybe this will be helpful, the same self that is illumining this lamp in this chair, not illumining, but it's the self of the lamp, the self of the chair, the self of this body, the self of the animal.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the same self.
Mm-hmm.
This lamp doesn't have a sukshma sharira. It doesn't have a subtle body to say, I'm a lamp, why are you rubbing on me? You know, I'm a chair, don't sit on me. You know, there's no subtle body for its own, from its own standpoint, mm-hmm. to be responding. But the self doesn't belong to the chair or to the lamp or to the body or to the animal. The self is the being, the self of the entire creation. It's the very me of Ishwara. So say the creation goes into unmanifest creation, unmanifest avyakta, and then comes out unmanifest. Nothing happens to me. You know, there's something that happens to the upadhis, you know, but not to the meanness of me. Another thing, a nice experience, is if you dream, when you wake up from a dream, if you can just catch that moment of waking up where you have this realization that even though that dream is gone, nothing has happened. All the nama-rupa, the whole scene is gone. And nothing has happened because what is actually there has not been touched. That's the satyam mitya. And it's a very vivid experience if you just notice it. So maybe you notice that when you next time you wake up. Because you don't even have to be exposed to knowledge to have that sensation that when the dream is gone and it was so real and you're so engaged in it and all of that, now the whole thing is gone, but nothing has happened. Because the very being, what is actually there, hasn't been touched at all. That's incredible, you know. But that's this reality. When you die, you think that there's death. There's no such thing. It simply does not exist because we are very used to, and take for granted. We take so for granted that we don't even think about it. We're experiencing complete change all of the time, right? At the same time, nothing is happening. Because nothing is happening, right? And so even though as a traveler, as a jiva, we may be traveling throughout this multi-dimensional creation, which is all just viewed as one interrelated whole, you know, you may... When this body drops, you continue on to... I mean, there's the network of laws, like we're living in this network of laws and everything is orderly in its own chaotic way. But when you go into other dimensions also, they're all interrelated. You're traveling where you've traveled millions, beginningless times before. There's nothing new in it. But that's not even the point. The point is that for you, who you actually are, there's not even any travel. You remain exactly the same. You know? You think you're traveling. But it's like, if they use the example like this, if I take like a clay pot, and I move the clay pot from point A to point B, the pot space is going to say, I'm traveling. You know, they're moving me. Pot space, they're moving me. You know, nothing's happening. Nobody's moving. You're not moving, you're never moving, you never have moved, you never can move. You're always exact, you're here, and you're always here, you're always the present. You are the infinite non-dual presence of every experience. You know? And it's personal. Because you are you. There's only one you, that's the only thing. But that doesn't make it any less personal.
But when
it's me.
You feel like it belongs to me.
It is you. When you say it belongs to me, that's the adyasa, where it belongs to me. This body, that's like the pot saying, mm-hmm. The clay belongs to me. Mm-hmm. And if I break, then my clayness, who I am, will break.
Yeah.
Will be dead. This is you. This me, the conscious being, the me that is so dear to me, that is beloved, the most beloved, it belongs to this body. And so this body dies, and therefore this me will die, you know? Or this me belongs to my mind, and yet my mind can go through all of these horrible, you know, machinations, you know, and make me miserable. I'm not becoming miserable. My mind's miserable, but I'm exactly the same. And that viveka you definitely will end up having. If you're to whatever degree you have it now, it'll just get more and more and more. Nothing happens to you. You're always the same. That's why these upset experiences, you should welcome them and say, okay, now, here's this horrible experience. And just notice where you are in that. Notice your own presence. And you are exactly the same. Whether it's a happy experience or a miserable one, nothing is happening. And the more you get to know that, the more kind of gestalt it starts. The fact of it starts coming more and more and more to the surface of your experience. It's always at the surface, but coming forward. It becomes
up?
More, your mind becomes more used to recognizing the ever changeless presence of yourself. It's not used to recognizing that, it's used to being that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the adyasa. Now it starts to recognize it, and then it recognizes more, and then it recognizes more. It's very nice.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about the text with his use of the word nirvana.
Nirvana is just, it means that which is absolutely free of an emotion. It's a Buddhist word also, but
right.
Buddhists don't own that word.
Right.
You know, that which is absolutely everything is totally snuffed out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a Sanskrit word, right? I mean, it predates those guys.
But in terms of like the vocabulary, you know, the kind of, I don't know, like the traditional Vedantic vocabulary, it's a...
Well, it's going to become even more interesting when we do chapter 4, because he's actually speaking in the vocabulary of different darshanas,
mm-hmm.
and negating them through that vocabulary.
Well, because I know that there have been certain kind of assumptions that maybe Gaudapada was in fact a Buddhist and that he's not really a non-dual, he's not an Advaita Vedanta.
Yeah, the Buddhists will try to say that.
Mm-hmm.
But once you start going through the verses, they would have to be a Vedantin to say it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even when you go through the Mandukya Upanishad, which Gaudapada also has a running commentary on, you can't, I've watched for that too, because I know from school,
mm-hmm.
and my own studies, that Gaudapada is sometimes considered to be a Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how they can do it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Have you tried?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean to go through the verses to see if you can to see how they could construe
No, because no one's specific. I haven't gotten any real specific of like, it's this verse. There's a non-specificity around these kinds of allegations or accusations, you know. So it's also really hard, but I just know that that's there, and so it's the first night that I've recognized a kind of,
that's just one word.
Of Buddhist vocabulary, and so, okay, I can see where there's then some confusion that comes in about...
But I could have done that. I did it the way Shankar and Swamiji did it, but there's even another way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the sun nirvanam.
Right.
This is what's associated with nirvanam. It means this is what the Buddhists associate with nirvanam. If you want to bring the Buddhists in,
mm-hmm.
that makes it really interesting. Because the Buddhists, they do talk. I can't go there right now. But I can go there. Let me just tell you really quickly. The Buddhists only accept two pramanas, pratyeksha and anumana. Perception and inference. They accept shabda, the use of words, only for what the Buddha experienced and revealed
mm-hmm.
to them,
mm-hmm.
to his students,
mm-hmm.
that they themselves can't know, but they take by shraddha,
mm-hmm.
what he said. They don't accept the Vedas
right.
or any of the other means of knowledge, just those two. Now, if they only accept those two, the whole everything they teach can only be proven or validated through pratyeksha, you know, perception
mm-hmm.
and inference.
Yeah, perception.
Otherwise, he won't say it, because they're all part of the same tradition. And so, therefore, the recognition of that non-dual Brahman, you know, is something that has to be recognized, but no words can point to it, because there's no Vedas,
mm-hmm.
right? And there's something else important there in that. But they all talk about it in poetry. All the Buddhists will talk about it. But it's something that you have to come upon. And they won't say
right.
what it is. They can can only use... There's two... We use words avacharta, the immediate meaning of the words, and laksharta, the implied meaning. They can't use the implied meaning. They can only use the vacharta, the immediate meaning of the words. And so if they say atma, they only mean what you take to be the Atma. That's the immediate meaning of the word. If I say self, say in the world, I say self. I'm myself. Okay, I mean this body, mind, sense organs complex. That's what I mean by the word self. Buddha will say, there is no such self. That's what you're calling self is an Atma. It's something like a chariot. It's infinitely divisible. So any word that you use is only good for referring to this world. There's no possibility of words referring to something other than what is here.
Oh, so they're trapped in a way.
Trapped in a way. And so the recognition of Brahman, which is there to be recognized, is recognized, right? But as itself, if I go to Nagarjuna, it's recognized as shunyata,
mm-hmm.
meaning that which is empty, of all namarupa.
Mm-hmm.
The absolute is that which is empty of namarupa, or name and form. Well, name and form is empty of essence. Name and form is shunyata also, emptiness. But empty of what? Empty of being, empty of essence. The absolute reality, paramartika, they use the word.
Mm.
The paramartika also is shunyata. But what is it empty of? Namarupa.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't bring the two together, because there's no Vedas,
mm-hmm.
no Upanishads, no means of knowledge.
There's
no way that the means of knowledge we have available to us as human beings can get there.
Mm-hmm.
Our means of knowledge that available to us cannot get there. And so we have to use, from a Buddhist perspective, you use perception and inference, the two that they accept, in order to show that the fourfold noble truth and all of that,
right.
you know.
Well, then they can't also really resolve duality. I mean, do they make assumptions of that?
Duality in the same way that we do, but they only have mithya with no satyam, so they can't use the word mithya.
Right.
So they're
infinitely interconnected, but there's nothing has any essence. An infinitely interconnected whole, but there's not, you can't, like peeling an onion, you can't find anything.
Right.
Primarily what we say for mitya. But they can't say mitya because they can't point to a satyam. So they keep the satyam, what we would call satyam, as something to be recognized. But not in a dual way. Your mind can't recognize it. The interconnected whole can't recognize it. It is what it is, which is Brahman. Brahman doesn't need the world to shine. But then they can't get to the mityatva of this. So then everybody goes around thinking, well, I'm Namarupa. I have no self. And then there's this thing to be recognized. So it's difficult.
Yeah.
But everybody's talking about the same reality. Because this is the reality that's
right.
here to be talked
right.
about. But Buddhism is difficult. Because
yeah.
they don't have
because
all of the...
they don't have the Shuddha Pramana. You know, there's... when you just dismiss everything and there's nothing there.
The thing is if you do dismiss everything that can be dismissed, you don't end up non-existent.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But
because
then,
Swamiji says, who's the one dismissing?
Yeah, but say you dismiss everything, 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 but you're always left with being, you know?
Right.
But then that being can be recognized as that Paramarthika Satyam that is free of Namarupa, but then it can't be, they don't know how to relate, bring the two together.
Yeah.
Anyway.
yeah.
I'm not really a Buddhist.
I agree.
To be able to talk in depth about it, you know. Hal can do it. There's some people who have a lot of Buddhism that can do that.
What can they do?
Can talk about it in a more educated way. I'm only half-baked and being able to really talk about it.
Well, we're not here for that anyway.
No, but anyway, it comes up. Okay, everybody.